Support for Under the Radar comes from Wellwithall. Wellwithall believes that self-care is community care. Premium products crafted for your daily wellness, from sleep support to heart health to your daily regimen. 20% of Wellwithall's profits are committed to leading the fight for health equity. They won't stop until it is truly Wellwithall.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And now for the part of the show we call Lanya, that's Creole for something extra. Relinquish describes the process of women giving up their children for adoption, a decision, it turns out, that is often about the privilege accorded adoptive mothers and the presumed inability of birth mothers to be parents, and much less about adoption as an alternative to abortion. Author Gretchen Sisson profiles the stories of birth mothers and breaks down the myths and misunderstandings about the American adoption process in her new book, Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. It's our April selection for Bookmarked, the Under the Radar Book Club. Gretchen Sisson is a qualitative sociologist in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Sisson studies abortion and adoption in the department's specialized research area, Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health. Her research has been cited in the Supreme Court's dissent in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization and by journalists from The Washington Post, NPR's All Things Considered, and other media outlets. She joins me now from Seattle. Welcome to Under the Radar, Dr. Sisson.
Thank you for having me, Callie.
The word that I think is that has been used most often in talking about your book is eye-opening and surprising, because I think most of us who have any knowledge of adoption think of it in a very heartwarming way, where more often than not, the child who needs a home is embraced by the adoptive parents. And the woman who is giving up the child for adoption has come to the conclusion that this is best for the child. As an example of that, here's a clip from the movie Juno, where Vanessa, the prospective mom, is invited by Juno to listen to the baby in her belly.
You should try talking to it, because, like, supposedly they can hear you, even though it's all, like, 10,000 leagues under the sea.
Hi, baby. It's me. It's Vanessa. I can't wait to meet you. Oh, God. That was magical.
But Dr. Sisson, as you have outlined for us based on extensive data, that scenario is happens less often than we would imagine, that the system is quite fraught overall, and there are traumatic harms along the way for those women who've made the decision to give up their children, sometimes even the adopted parents and the adoptees themselves. So I want to start by setting the table for exactly what you did. First of all, you're not talking about the period of time where there were closed adoptions. So we're really focusing on the period of time after Roe in from 2000. And why did you decide that that was the period of time that needed to be looked at?
Part of what sparked my interest in studying adoption was reading Anne Fessler's brilliant book, The Girls Who Went Away, that really chronicled the lives of relinquishing mothers before Roe v. Wade, at this time of really coercive, secretive, closed adoptions during the late 50s, 60s, very early 70s. And I wanted to understand the way that this system that she looked at that historical moment was functioning contemporaneously, like what was actually happening in adoptions when I started this work in 2010. And I really wanted to explore the ways that adoption was or wasn't serving relinquishing mothers at that point in time, and how much had really changed from that baby scoop era of pre-Roe.
Just to make even clearer, you interviewed lots of women, beginning, as you say, in 2000 and then 2010 and then 10 years later. So that we'll talk about that a little bit later. But you had an opportunity to talk to these same women over a period of a decade.
Yes. And I think that that was really important because what I noticed in my first round of interviews in 2010 was that you had mothers with a real range of experiences around the adoption. And women who were further out from their adoption were often much more critical of the experience and how well it had served them and their children. But there were mothers in more recent adoptions. So again, this is 2010. So in adoptions that happened, you know, 2005, 6, 7, 8, who were feeling really optimistic and hopeful about their adoptions. They felt that this was the best choice for them and their child, and they were really hopeful. What I wanted to understand was, are these more recent adoptions actually better? Are they serving people better? Are there, you know, more harm reductive practices in place, more ways of supporting parents and adoptive families in having open adoptions that are truly meaningful to them? So has adoption gotten better, or do more mothers just come to a critical place over time? And the only way to do that was to interview the same group of women and see how they changed 10 years later.
And the other thing, because Roe obviously stands as a pivotal point, or the decision to overturn Roe in the Dobbs decision, is that I just assumed, I mean, I just can't believe how many assumptions I had as I read your book, that if you were denied an abortion, because that's at the key of this, then adoption would be somehow more embraced by women as a real viable option for them. And it turns out that, as you say in your book, those women are just not interested in adoption, which was a little shocking to me. I wonder if you'd read from your book from page 63, just talking about that point.
Here's a quote from the chapter Choosing Life, which really looks at the role that abortion politics play in how people make decisions about abortion and adoption. Most women seeking abortion are fundamentally uninterested in adoption. In a survey of over 5,000 abortion patients, they were asked a series of true-false questions, including, I want to put the baby up for adoption instead of an abortion. In response, 99% of participants said it was false, and exactly 0% said it was true. 1% said kind of. Adoption was often ruled out, if it was considered at all, because women simply felt it was not right for them, either because they had health reasons for not wanting to continue their pregnancies, or because they felt there were already too many children in need of homes. Another study of interviews with 70 women who'd recently had abortions found that none of them seriously considered adoption, mostly because they believed it would be too emotionally traumatic. These feelings about adoption were equally held by focus groups of both pro-choice and anti-abortion women, all of whom considered adoption to be emotionally painful, not just for mothers, but for the children who would be relinquished. In another study examining the decision-making of women who had an abortion, most of them were unequivocal in ruling out adoption. And then the other important thing to note is that this general disinterest in adoption holds for women who were denied access to abortions. So in the Turnaway study, which I worked on with my UCSF colleagues, we found that among women who were denied access to abortion and gave birth as a result, 91% of them were parenting the children born from those pregnancies. Only 9% relinquished for adoption. Now, that 9% is really small compared to the 91%, but it's actually an incredible increase over the number of adoption relinquishments in the general population, which is just about 0.5% of all births. Which goes to show two things. One, that when you deny people abortion care, you're going to have far, far, far more people parenting in circumstances that they did not plan or choose than you're going to have adoptions. But it also shows that when you constrain people's choices, when you remove access to abortion, when you make parenting untenable in specific ways, you are going to see meaningful increases in adoption.
There are so many contraindicated things in your book that just are kind of mind-boggling to think about. So the statistics that you just read, and I should pause and say my guest is Dr. Gretchen Sisson, a qualitative sociologist whose latest book is Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. And it's our April selection for Bookmark, the Under the Radar Book Club. So through your book, I'm bounced from one end to the other thinking, I thought that, and no, that's not it. You came to the table having done a lot of research in this area before. Were there any surprises as you delved deeper into wanting to explain the system in a way that the rest of us could understand and how it's not working that surprised you?
I think what surprised me the most was when I did the 2020 interviews, the 10-year follow-up interviews. What surprised me was how universally critical the mothers became. Even a lot of the mothers who had been very optimistic, very delighted with their adoptions early on. So in the book, I tell the story of one woman I call Leah. When I first interviewed Leah in 2010, she was like very effusive about her adoption. This was going to be wonderful for her and her child. She felt very excited. She felt very close to his adoptive parents. You know, they were going to have this wonderful open adoption. It was going to allow her to pursue what she wanted in her life. And, you know, I asked her, what should adoption look like? And she said, mine. Every adoption should look like mine. And she was serving on, birth parent panels with her adoption agency and sort of proselytizing this decision that she'd made. When I spoke with her 10 years later, you know, I mentioned this. I said, you told me that every adoption should look like yours. And she just sort of sighed and said, yeah, that sounds like something I would have said. But I've come to believe that this adoption was just really unnecessary. And she had a lot of conflicted feelings. She felt like her son was struggling with his identity being an adopted person. She felt like he was having trouble connecting with his adoptive parents. As he grew up, it was clear that he had some neurodivergencies that they were struggling to connect with him around. So she was willing to go through a lot of sadness and grief for herself if she believed it was serving her child well. But once she felt like it wasn't serving her son, that's when she came to this much more cynical, sad place of understanding what had happened and recognizing how little support she really would have needed to parent, and saying that she just felt like she needed one person in her community to say, we're going to support you. She grew up in a pretty conservative place and just felt like being pregnant and unmarried, she faced a lot of stigma and no one really wanted to hold her up and say, you can do this. And so I think that that's one specific story, but that recurring theme, hearing that over and over again, even from women who felt good about where they had been 10 years earlier, made me understand really deeply how the system is not set up to hold these experiences and give them the support and investment that they need in the long term.
And I want to pick up that point, because in the book you make clear that some of the decisions by the birth or natural mothers really come down from an economic standpoint for some. And let's be clear, the women that you interviewed were across the spectrum across the economic spectrum. So there were some, you know, better off than others. Everybody wasn't a poor woman with absolutely no other force by an economic situation. But for those women that were in so many of the instances, something as small as, relatively small as $1,000 would have made a difference as they were making a decision about whether or not they could get to the next level to really parent the child. I personally found that quite shocking. But as you demonstrated in your book, this happens a lot. Could you speak about that?
Yeah. And I think it's important to understand what they mean when they say, I would have just needed $1,000 to parent. it's not that they would have needed $1,000 to raise the child. Of course, it costs more than $1,000 to raise a child. What they needed was $1,000 to get through wherever they were at the time, right? Maybe they were relinquishing because they felt that they were in an unsafe relationship with someone that they didn't want to co-parent with. $1,000 would have allowed them to put down a security deposit on a new apartment. And have a better living situation that they could bring a baby home to. It's not about, I need $1,000 to raise a child. It's, I need $1,000 to make a different choice. And I often say the $1,000 doesn't get them from A to Z. They just need to get from A to B, and then they're going to figure out how to get to C, to D, to E. They're going to go one step at a time. The way that so many American families who are living in poverty, who are, you know, struggling with housing instability, of food insecurity, that's where they're going to be. It's going to be constant work, but they'll have their child with them.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and my guest is qualitative sociologist Dr. Gretchen Sisson, whose latest book is Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. It's our April selection for Bookmarked, the Under the Radar Book Club. Now, Dr. Sisson, you made clear in your book to talk about some of the other extenuating circumstances and factors that just are, that most adoptive parents are more well off, sometimes very more well off than the birth or natural parents. And there's also often a racial difference, that a lot of the adoptive parents are white, and there's, you know, there are not that many white babies for adoption, so that you end up in cross-racial adoptions, whether that was intentional for the adoptive parent or not, and that raises many other issues. After reading your book, I realized when media portrays this, the birth or natural mother in a tension with the adoptive mother or the prospective adoptive mother, they never come off well. And I just wanted to allow people to hear what we hear all the time and don't even think about it as we're watching some of this media. So here's a clip from the movie Losing Isaiah.
Don't do this to Isaiah. Don't do what? Tell him the truth? That his real mama is as black as he is? Black. All you people think about is color.
You people?
You people?
Well, me and Isaiah, we the same kind of people. But didn't you notice?
I'll just note, Dr. Sisson, that in the comments on YouTube, wherever we got that clip, are people saying, who would ever choose Halle Berry playing the mother? Yeah. Who would choose her? Of course, everybody would choose the adoptive mother. And that's sort of embedded in our image of adoption.
We see two specific types of stories about relinquishing mothers in our popular culture. And I think that you've really illustrated them with the clips that you shared today. So there's Juno, right? Juno, who's like kind of indifferent to her pregnancy, right? And very flippant and joking, and wants a closed adoption and finds a couple in the penny saver, right? And so you have that model, that birth mothers are just kind of uninterested in their children, don't want to have an ongoing relationship with their children. That was not true for any of the mothers that I interviewed. Not all of them could have a relationship with their child at every given point in time. It was hard. It was painful for a lot of them. Sometimes the adoptive parents would close the adoption. Sometimes birth parents would limit contact based on where they were in their lives. But they all fundamentally wanted to know their child and to have their child know them. On the other side, you have these mothers, like in Losing Isaiah, where their desire to be connected with their child is a threat to the adoptive family. And I think that these are both different ways of pathologizing and stigmatizing and dismissing the very real desire of relinquishing mothers to continue to be in relationships with their child in some capacity. And most adoptions today are open to a certain extent. Now, what that mean? That could mean that they're just getting pictures from the agency a couple times a year. It could also mean, like some of the mothers I spoke with, that they're babysitting their children occasionally, that maybe they're going on family vacations, right? Very, you know, kinship open adoption dynamics. And so when you only have these two types of stories to tell, the one where the mother isn't there, doesn't care, or the one where her desire to be part of her child's life is a problem, is a threat, then you're not making space for openness in adoption that is well supported, well understood, and ultimately child-centered, and rooted in what the child needs to know about where they've come from, who their family is. And I think that that is a significant shortcoming in how we think about adoption and what we're trying to accomplish through these relationships that last an entire life.
I want to note, because part of the title of your book is The Politics of Adoption, that adoption is supported in a bipartisan way. So there's not that. Each side of the spectrum has different thoughts about why, you know, but the bottom line is everybody along the political spectrum thinks this is a great idea. The other part that came through in the book that I just was unaware of is how transactional a lot of this is, and how the rights, and I guess in writ large, of the birth mother are kind of squished away because they just didn't get proper counseling or have an understanding of what their rights ought to be or all of that. So, for example, when you talked about most adoptions today are open, as I learned in your book, well, that's not really a legal contract. So at any point, the adopted parents, and have, as demonstrated in your book, can just decide, we don't want to be in touch with you anymore. Now, that, as you've described, is not good for the child, and hopefully most sets of parents on either side would see that. But it does happen, and it happens more than we think. So I ask you now, there are some women in the book, birth and natural mothers, who offered some solutions about making at least the process different for what, as you point out, is a permanent separation from the birth mother. That's permanent. And people, in my mind, I knew that, but I didn't really focus on it. So some of them talk about more conversation between birth mothers and prospective birth mothers, making sure that these decisions are not made really early in the pregnancy when everybody's, got all kinds of emotions running on, that, and counseling and more counseling and more discussion seem to be a really high priority. What would you suggest as maybe the best solution to begin to reframe how this adoption process is done?
I think the most important thing is to consider and then address the ways that adoption is really a market-driven system, right? So one other myth that we have about adoption is that we have so many babies that need to be adopted. And actually, we don't. Within the private adoption system, we have up to 45 sets of prospective adoptive parents for every baby that's relinquished in this country. This is a very, very high demand and a very, very low supply of babies. And it feels uncomfortable to talk about human beings within a supply and demand system, but this is a market. And once you have a market-driven system, you have agencies that are motivated to find ways of separating babies from their families in order to continue to meet the demands of the system. And we have for-profit adoption agencies. We have nonprofit adoption agencies that, even if they don't have a straightforward profit motive, they still need to facilitate a certain number of adoptions in order to continue to exist as an organization. And you see for-profit adoption brokers, attorneys that sort of operate in this space, that do really aggressive advertising, targeting vulnerable pregnant people, selling the idea of adoption. And so you see just a huge amount of money going into selling the idea that adoption is a meaningful solution here. And I think that that shapes so much of the way adoption is practiced. It leads to some of the most aggressive, coercive practices, but it also means that a lot of relinquishing mothers don't receive full options counseling during their pregnancies. It means that they aren't, in most states, they are not required to have their own legal representation before terminating their parental rights. And you see these type of practices allowed to foster within a system because of this market demand.
What do you want people to take away from your book?
I'm hoping that I wrote the book for people that share a certain level of values with me, right? People who believe in reproductive freedom. People who don't, they can read it as well. I hope they learn something. But I really wrote this book for people who believe that we should be supporting families, believe that we should be supporting mothers, and believe that people deserve a right to reproductive autonomy, but have never thought deeply about what adoption means in relationship to those conversations. And so I'm hoping that I can just open the door for people to reconsider the ways that adoption functions, who it serves, who it fails, and what that means more broadly for how we think about supporting American families.
Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Sisson.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gretchen Sisson is a qualitative sociologist whose latest book is Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. It's available in bookstores and online now. That's it for this week's edition of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Listen to us online at GBH News or wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date with our programming. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley is a production of GBH, produced by Jesse Steinmetz and engineered by Dave Goodman. Our intern is Tu Lee. Our theme music is Fish and Chips by We Are Two Saxies, Grace Kelly, and Leo P. Listen again on Wednesday and see you here at 6 p.m. next Sunday for a new episode. I'm Callie Crossley. Thanks for listening.